Professor Josh Silver, good morning.
Hello.
You are an atomic physicist and professor of physics at the University of Oxford, and you are also the director of the Center for Vision in the Developing World, where you are working on adaptive eyeglasses.
Yes, that's correct, but we really work on issues of vision in the developing world more widely than just adaptive eyeglasses.
Okay.
We work on, as the website for the centre shows, we have a number of research interests in the field of vision in the developing world.
Okay. That's great. But I was more interested actually on the adaptive eyeglass that you developed there, and I was wondering what is the concept of this eyeglass.
Well, in fact, people tend to see me as a chap that invented some eyeglasses, but I would put it slightly differently myself and try and explain where the concept comes from and what it's all about. I started working with lenses and mirrors, optical elements, where you could change their certain of their features easily. In particular, mirrors whose radius of curvature could be changed, and lenses where the surface of the lens, the surface curvature could be changed. In other words, lenses and mirrors where the focal length of each element is under your control. And this actually led me to start thinking about whether if you look through a lens where you can change the focus, whether this might be useful for vision correction. In fact, looking back historically, I made a number of variable focus or variable power lenses in the 1980s, and I discovered that if I looked through one and changed the power, I could correct my myopia. And that led me to ask the question, could other people do the same thing? Could people that needed corrective eyewear, could they in fact, in essence, make it for themselves? And what I was really working on, as I later came to understand, was a question. It's not so much the device as the underlying question. If you equip someone with lenses where they can change the focus, can they perform a refraction on themselves? To try to be a bit more clear, suppose you give someone a pair of glasses where the lenses are variable in power. If you give them some instructions and tell them to, say, look at a reading chart and change the power of the lenses, would they be able to set the lens power such that they had given themselves good vision correction? So really, that's what I'd really be working on. The eyeglasses that I made, fluid-filled lens eyeglasses, are just one of a number of different approaches that you can make to creating a technology like this.
Okay. And how do they work?
The variable power lenses that I've designed are filled with a fluid, and the surface of the lens is formed by a thin plastic membrane of good optical quality. And if you change the amount of fluid in the lens, it changes the surface curvature. And therefore, you have a lens where the power of the lens can actually be changed from positive to negative, and the standard lenses that I've made have a power range of about 12 diopters. They can go from +6 to -6 or even a little bit more.
Okay.
And you do that just by adding or subtracting fluid from the fill in the lens.
Okay, so
I hope I've put that clearly.
Yes. So I also understand that anybody can do it. That.
Well, let me be more precise. In the 1980s, when I actually started playing around with these lenses like this, I really posed a question: could someone carry out a refraction on themselves with a suitable lens of the sort I could make, or some other suitable lens? And I set out to research that, and I actually showed that people can, people can self-refract with good accuracy.
Okay.
And I carried out research on that, carried it out over a number of years, and have actually published some papers on it. And if you look on our website, there are copies of the research papers that we published, which show how accurately a sample population could self-refract.
Okay, and I also seen on your website that the cost of one pair of eyeglasses is around $19.
Well, currently yes, but again, maybe if I. Sorry, you had a question. Please ask your question and then I'll answer.
I was just wondering what makes this product a low cost technology?
Well, let me again go back a step and explain how I came to develop these glasses as I did. I initially found I could perform a refraction on myself with good accuracy with a lens which essentially was very simple to make, very simple and not expensive. So that led me to have into a dialogue with a gentleman who in the early 1990s was the director of the program for the prevention of blindness at the World Health Organization. And I explained my approach, which was to make simple eyeglasses which could be tunable, variable. And I told him that I thought, well, what I actually did was I asked him how many people in the world needed corrective eyewear. And he said it was about 1 billion people. That was the estimate then from the WHO. And he'd done some research on that himself. And I told him that the approach I was looking at looked as though it might be promising and may be able to solve that problem. And he said, well, if you can do that, you should do it. Those are his words. And then he said to me, you've got to make it cheap.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, how much? And he said, well, in order to solve this problem, because of the very large numbers of people, in effect, because what he was saying was, because of the very large numbers of people involved and the fact that many of them are in the developing world and very poor, it has to be inexpensive. So one of my design criteria from the word go was to be able to make the device at very low cost. And that's been one of the drivers. You have to be able to, if you want to deliver mass vision correction to very large populations in the developing world, you can't really have a very high cost because it won't be affordable. So it has to be affordable. Has to be affordable to populations who live on about $1 a day.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a requirement rather than something you discover when you make the device. It was one of the design criteria, but because there's nothing inherently expensive in the eyeglasses, in fluid-filled lens eyeglasses. So as they go up in volume, they will come down in price.
Yes.
But in fact, most eyeglasses, although people are charged a great deal of money for eyeglasses, one of the reasons for that is that the way they are delivered, you have a highly trained professional who's spending their professional time on the thing, and you also have an industry, or several industries in fact, which are hoping to make a decent margin on the thing. So it ends up the device, the standard eyewear that is worn, say in Canada or England or America, has passed through many hands. It's a very sophisticated device, and a lot is charged for it. But if you look at the components of eyeglasses, they're not inherently very expensive.
That's true, yes. So I was also wondering, in terms of the design of the eyeglasses. So I believe it's also part of the cost, but is it also important to make this technology work? Is the shape important?
Well, that's a very interesting question. And in fact, if you look at the basic device that I actually brought, took into production out of interest and got it to, they're now being worn, 30,000 people in about 15 countries wear the original adaptive eyeglasses. The lenses are round, and they're round because in that generation of device, if the lens is not round, then they become so-called astigmatic. So you have to have them round. But there will be ways found which will lead to non-round lenses of the same sort of general design. So it's at the moment the basic eyeglasses which are used are round, but you can foresee developments where it will be possible to make non-round ones. But you can also foresee other lens developments where you will have other sorts of lenses which will have the feature that you can change their power.
Okay, well, that's very interesting.
Yeah, in fact, if you look on the Vision for the Center for Vision in the Developing World website, there's a little description there of the different lens technologies which have been developed, which give the property that you can change the power of the lens. And the fluid-filled one is actually very, very old.
Okay.
The idea of using lenses with flexible boundaries filled with a fluid goes way back. It goes back to the 18th century. And there were quite nice variable power fluid-filled lenses made in the 19th century. So it's actually an old concept, but before the work that I've been involved in, I'm not aware of anyone actually suggesting that it gives a good way of. I'm not aware of people suggesting that self-refraction, where the wearer makes their own eyeglasses, is something which would have an application to many people in the developing world. And in a sense, I think one of the things I've done is to research self-refraction to see how accurate it is, and also to make the suggestion that it has an application to very large populations in the developing world. And you might also ask the question, why is it that there's such a need for eyewear in the developing world? And I believe that the answer to that question is that in the developing world, you really don't have enough eye care professionals to meet the needs of the people. So using the models which we are familiar with in the developed world, they're a bottleneck. They cannot be applied to very large populations simply because there aren't enough trained personnel to apply the methods with which we are familiar.
Mm-hmm.
So one way of getting around that problem in the present day is to find a route whereby a wearer effectively creates their own prescription eyewear, and that's in effect one of the things that I've done.
Okay, and what are the results in terms of improving the quality of life of the person using it?
Well, we haven't yet done the detailed research of that, and we intend to do that. But in a way, I would argue that it's some of the effects are self-evident, because if you think of someone living in the developing world who is dependent upon dependent upon close work for their income. Take an example of a tailor or someone that a craft worker or a farmer who has to have good clear vision, good near vision in order to get an income. If when they become presbyopic, you know, actually without research, you know that they will not be able to see close up. So you know that there will be a devastating impact on their ability to work, for example, or read. You know, if you become presbyopic and you don't have eyeglasses, you can't read small print. So in a sense, you don't need to research some of these things because they are self-evident. But we intend to do research on this, but in a way it's obvious that if a presbyopic person can't read because they can't focus on the print, that is sufficiently obvious that it doesn't need to be researched, if you see what I mean.
Of course, yes.
So you can immediately, and once if you just look at the population demographics, you see that there's something like 25% of the world are about age 45 or over in round figures. Again, a lot of this information is on our website. And that means that 25% of the world's population who are 45 or older, they're just not going to be able to read or do close work. And it makes it so it has an obvious impact on their income and on their quality of life.
Of course.
And there's another interesting fact, which is that children who need refractive correction, correcting their refractive error, will typically be educationally disadvantaged. And there are large numbers of children in that bracket as well. If they're myopic and if they're in a classroom situation, a fraction of them will not be able to see a blackboard, so their education will be compromised. Mm-hmm. And if you get them so that they can see the blackboard, they in principle can learn from standard classroom procedure.
That's true. And and finally, because you are a research center also, what are the next steps in your research activities related to adaptive eyeglasses?
Well, I would say that our research is not just related to adaptive eyeglasses. We're actually interested in vision issues in the developing world. One of the things we'd like to do is to try and understand the incidence of refractive error globally, mm-hmm. and that requires research. We're also interested in accommodation, mechanisms of accommodation, and we also have a project funded by the World Bank to try to find a strategy to deliver corrective eyewear to children in the developing world. And actually, if anyone is interested in this, the best thing to do is to go and look at the website because it has a lot of detail about it. So, but those are the areas that we're interested in the impact of uncorrected vision on developing world populations and how you deal with that. And we also have an interest actually in having come up with this technology, we're actually interested in seeing to what extent we can perfect a self-refraction technique. And in fact, that leads to other very interesting questions like how when you take a patient or a subject and you try to measure their refractive error, what is the most reliable way of doing that? And it's interesting because you find that different people have different views about what the best procedure is, and it's something, and yet there's a bit of physics that underlies it. So this is something that we are researching as well. But as I said, this is actually laid out in our website, and people who are interested should read it, mm-hmm. and then they should write and tell us if they think we've got anything wrong. And that way we will be able to improve the thing. You see, our center has not been up and running that long. We've presented some research papers at meetings, and we've really only just open the thing seriously.
So, yeah, there's still a lot of work.
There's a great deal of work, yes. Yeah. But think about it. You see, the number of people that require, that need a corrective eyewear in the world, if I had to guess now, knowing what I know now, I would say that the need for corrective eyewear, that the fraction of the world's population that need corrective eyewear is probably between 50% and 60%, maybe a bit more. Mm-hmm. And that would probably strike you as a huge fraction, would it? Does that sound large to you?
It is, yes.
But if you look at North America or Great Britain, again, and this information is on the center's website, you'll find that in countries like, in developed world countries, so-called developed world countries, something over 50%, in fact, typically over 60% of people wear corrective eyewear of one sort or another. They either wear glasses or they have contacts or they've had mm-hmm. refractive surgery. But when we say need corrective eyewear, it's an interesting question. How do you define need? And you'll find that in those in the populations in the developed world, usually the practitioner who's dealing with them is trying to get them to see as well as possible, which is something like 20/20 or better. In other words, you have to have an acuity criteria. And if you push your subject or your patient's acuity, you try and get the best possible, you're going to find that well over half your population will need corrective eyewear. And so then if you then ask the question of the developing world, I've had conversations with people who said to me, oh, well, it's different in the developing world. And what they're really saying is that then they don't think that one should necessarily work to the same standards in the developing world. And I think that's quite wrong. Mm-hmm. I think that you have to work to the same standards everywhere.
That's true.
And if you do that, then you find that the fraction, there isn't, it's a physiological fact almost, and the fraction requiring corrective eyewear is going to be, it does vary a bit from population to population. In fact, it varies quite a lot, but it's always rather high. And again, as I would say, we haven't yet published on this. We intend to publish fairly soon, but we've made presentations at a number of conferences, and our posters are on our website. And we really welcome comments from anyone who is interested in this subject.
Mm-hmm. Well, Professor Silver, thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome.
This was very interesting.
Oh, well, thank you very much, and nice to talk to you.